Okay, well, thanks for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here again. And so, I'm going to tell you about a landscape of superconducting membranes, which is based on some work that I've been doing this last year or so. And particularly today, I'm going to talk about some work with Frederick Deneff, Chris Herzog, and Gary Horowitz. So there's going to be a slightly lengthy introduction to this talk, firstly because I want to motivate it by telling you a bit about non-conventional superconductors. And then I'm also going to motivate it from a slightly different angle as a discussion of the string landscape from a slightly different point of view. And then after this introduction, I'm going to tell you what a holographic superconductor is and what you can calculate with it. Okay, so background number one is superconductivity. So let me just remind you or tell you how a conventional superconductor works, because that's where we want to start. So although superconductivity was discovered over 100 years ago, it wasn't until the 1950s that the first consistent and correct microscopic theory was written down, and that's BCS theory by Dean Cooper and Schrieffer. And the essence of this theory is that superconductivity is caused by spontaneous symmetry breaking in which a bilinear operator in electrons condenses. Okay, so that's charged. And now that might seem a funny thing to happen because electrons want to repel each other because of the Coulomb force. So the first important thing to realize is that the electrons in a metal are not the electrons in the standard model. And the Coulomb force between them is screened. Okay, so it's not a very important, well, it's not the dominant force. And instead, there's actually an attractive force between the electrons due to the phonons on the lattice, which is just vibrations of the ions of the lattice. So it's this phonon-mediated force that causes the electrons to pair and condense. And you can think of this as instability of the Fermi surface. Okay, so the essence of, okay, so then what this does is when this operator condenses, this schematically is a pair of electrons, dressed electrons, so electrons in the metal, and that obviously breaks the U1 electromagnetic symmetry, and that's already enough to know that you're going to get superconductivity. And the argument goes something like this, so how do we tell if something's superconducting? So we calculate the conductivity. The conductivity is defined in Ohm's law. Okay, so Ohm's law relates the current and the electric field. So in a superconductor, there's going to be we should call it an Anderson-Higgs mechanism in this context. And that means that the photon is going to get a mass because of the fact that the symmetry is broken. And so when you calculate the current, which is just ds dA, it's going to be the mass times the vector potential. And then let's just work in a gauge. Let's work in a gauge where AT is zero, and then the electric field up to minus signs is something like I omega AX, and that's what I've written here. And then we can see, by comparing this with Ohm's law, that sigma is going to diverge in the DC limit as you go to zero frequency. Okay, so that's superconductivity. Of course, BCS theory didn't describe it in quite this language, but that's a very general phenomenon. So spontaneously broken electromagnetism is superconductivity. And of course, BCS theory was very successful and made many predictions. One prediction, for example, is that it predicts, this is the mass gap. So in a superconductor, there's a mass gap, a bit like in QCD. Okay, it tells you the mass gap as a function of the critical temperature, the mass gap at zero temperature as a function of the critical temperature. Okay, so those are two a priori different scales. You need to have a dynamical theory to relate. So, you know, you might have different materials. They have different TCs. You multiply by 3.5, and this is the mass gap predicted in, at least in weakly coupled BCS theory. And indeed, this number, plus minus 10% or so, is observed in many conventional superconductors. Here's some other data. So this is the curve of some definition of the mass gap as a function of temperature. So this is essentially the condensate. So at TC, the condensate turns on, and then it goes to some critical value. Some value at zero temperature. Okay, so this would be this mass gap. Oh, and the curve is BCS theory, and these data points are various superconductors like niobium, tantalum, and tin. Okay, so BCS theory was great, and in fact, I learned a lot about superconductivity from a book by Parks that was written in the 1960s. And the introduction to this book, it says, it's a two-volume book that has basically everything about conventional superconductors in it. And in the introduction, it says that the reason they're writing this book is they want to put the final nail in the coffin of superconductivity. Okay, so 1960s and superconductivity, you know, was like the turn of the century before quantum mechanics, because, well, I'm about to tell you that in 1987, various superconductors were discovered that were not describable by BCS theory. And so before I tell you that, I want to tell you, what does non-BCS mean? Okay, so there are two senses in which it might mean non-BCS. So let me just tell you in a bit more detail what BCS theory is. So BCS theory has a very nice, by the way, there's a very nice description of BCS theory in the TASI lectures by Polchinski. It's called something like effective field theories in the Fermi surface. It's an effective field theory description of superconductivity. And so what the effective field theory is you have some electrons which have some kind of kinetic term, I guess something like this. And then there's a coupling. Okay, I'm going to be very, this is very schematic. There's some coupling between the electrons and some scalar field, which is the phonon, if you like, the vibrations of the lattice. And what basically all you do is you integrate this out, and that gives you some four Fermi coupling. And then crucially, it has a minus sign, which makes it attractive force. Okay, and that's essentially, and then you can show that this coupling is enough to induce a condensate for the bilinear in the electrons if this sign is negative. Okay, so that implies. Okay, you can read all about it. It's only two lectures. It's short. So 91, 92 maybe.
Do you require the mass term for psi 2?
92.
Yeah, that's right. So in fact, if you put it at finite temperature, that's like adding a mass term and you'll break this effect. Okay, so when I say non-BCS, that might mean two things. So here's a weak version of what non-BCS means. So a weak version of non-BCS is that the pairing mechanism might not be due to phonons, but it might be due to, say, some magnetic interaction between the electrons. And so, for example, people talk about paramagnons in this context. And that's non-BCS in the sense that microscopically it's not what BCS theory describes, but it's not a very big difference. All it means is this phi field is not going to be a phonon, but it's going to be something else. Right. So, for example, you can have spin-spin interactions between the electrons, which is something like S dot S prime, where S is the spin. So that's something like psi and sigma. Psi, where this is a Pauli matrix. So this is also a quadratic interaction between the electrons, but it's due to their spins. Okay. And in fact, this happens. So it's non-BCS, but you know, it's still affecting field theory. Okay, and it's still ultimately boiled down to some psi to the fourth, weakly coupled psi to the fourth interaction. So a stronger version of what non-BCS might mean is if really the stuff's just inherently strongly coupled and there are no charged quasi-particles at all. So there are no electrons, there are no phonons, there are no paramagnons, there's no nothing. It's just a soup of strongly coupled stuff out of which you're going to get a condensate. And I think this is the kind of thing that conventional condensed matter physics might have a harder time conceptualizing. And I want to say that there are potentially candidates for this stronger case. This weaker case just definitely happens. And there are also candidates for this case if you're close to what's called the quantum critical point. So let me tell you about that. Okay, so here are two phase diagrams for non-conventional superconductors. This one is a so-called heavy fermion compound, and this is real data. And this is a schematic phase diagram for a high TC Cooper rate superconductor. So this axis is temperature. And this is some knob that you have on the system. So in this case, it's pressure. In this case, it's hole doping. So hole doping means that you take out, so for example, strontium. So what is it? Lanthanum. This is a high TC superconductor with some numbers here. And what you do is you, I think maybe there's a, I'm not sure about these numbers. But what you do is you, This may be wrong, but it's schematically correct. So what you do is you take out some of these atoms and replace them with the lanthanum atoms, and that's doping. This fraction X is the doping. And what it does is it changes the number of electrons that are available for transport. So what you're effectively dialing in this axis is the charge density of electrons, okay, the size of the Fermi surface. Okay, so but it doesn't really matter for what I want to stake. So this is some axis that you can tune. This is the phase diagram. So if you have some region in both of them, let's talk about this one first. So this is an anti-ferromagnetic state. So that means that the electrons are spin up, spin down, alternating, okay, on each side. That's an anti-ferromagnetic order. And then this is a normal state where they're not, where it's not ordered. Okay, so suppose you have some finite temperature and you dial the pressure. So that means you're going to go across here. So then what happens is that there's going to be a phase transition, a normal finite temperature phase transition, as you go from the antiferromagnetic state to the superconducting state. Okay. And now imagine cooling the system down, and it looks like what is going to happen. Okay, suppose this little dome wasn't here, and this thing went all the way down. So this happens with some other materials. But you had a picture like this. So at this point here, at zero temperature, the phase transition at zero temperature would be what is called a quantum critical point. Okay, it's a zero temperature phase transition. And so this is driven by quantum fluctuations rather than by classical thermodynamical fluctuations. Okay. But instead, this doesn't happen, and you get this superconducting dome. And so this region here becomes superconducting. And so it's rather tempting. I mean, if you just see this plot, it seems obvious that the existence of superconductivity is somehow tied to the fact that there's this quantum critical point here. And actually, it's fairly well understood in this case. All right. Now, this is a high TC superconductor, and we see that there's a similar structure. So you have the antiferromagnetic state, that has a superconducting dome. The thing is that these high TCs are a bit messier, and so there's this, so you see words like strange metal or pseudo gap, which is like a gap, but it isn't. And I think it's, although there have been some very nice experiments in the last year, I think it's still fair to say that this region is not fully understood. And over here, this is a normal Fermi. However, in fact, one reason that these heavy fermion compounds are studied so much is that they look similar to the high TC compounds. And so, you know, some people think that the fact that these diagrams are sufficiently similar means that there's some quantum critical point lurking somewhere in this phase diagram, possibly off on another axis, and that's controlling this dome. Okay. And in fact, so there is experimental evidence for a nearby quantum critical point for this system. For example, you see these things called stripes, which are where the electron charge density is spatially modulated. Okay, so you look in your electron microscope, and you see that the charge is sort of in line. So this is where the charge, most of the electrons are. And those are called stripes. And there's also evidence of some scaling behavior here. So it may be that there's also a quantum critical point in this system too, although that's definitely not established beyond doubt. So what if there's a quantum critical point? So the point about quantum critical points is that, you know, generically, okay, they can be free. Basically, either they're free or they're weakly coupled. Okay, because a free theory can still also be scaled invariant. And in fact, the kind of quantum critical points you get here are generally just free points. Well, they're normally treated as free points. Right. So, but if it's not free, then it has a good chance of being strongly coupled, and then you have a good chance of having non-VCS behavior. Now,
can I ask a nice question? Yes. So these phase diagrams, they are at zero chemical potential?
Well, it kind of depends what you mean. So you can think of this whole dome thing as a chemical potential, if you like, as a charge density. In fact, no, it isn't the right way to think
about it. We see the nearby CBDS ice. Where's that first time?
So in this, well, okay. So yeah, so, well, there are two possibilities. One is that it's really a lot like these guys. So there are two, where they're on the critical point, that was the question, right? Yeah. So it could be that it's literally here. Actually, I'm going to show you a plot suggesting this case. And that, you know, there's some disorder or whatever. That this line should be like the dotted line in the left-hand plot. The silica region wants to do this, but then some other junk happens, and then for some reason you get this line. Okay, and in that case, you want to say there's a quantum critical point here. Yeah, that's one possibility. Another picture we can draw is something like this one. So actually, there's a little dip here. Okay, this experimentally exists. And so another dip is that this is some other axis, some coupling you can tune, that you may or may not be able to tune experimentally, but in the space of theories, you're free to add another axis. And there could be an insulating phase here. But in fact, this would be the striped phase. So it could either be on the axis or slightly off the axis.
The point between the anti-ferromagnet and the pseudo gap is now gone down to zero temperature. So am I supposed to think of that as a...
Yeah, I should really get a good answer to this question because I've had it more than once. So for some reason, I don't see anybody studying that point. I don't know exactly why. I think the disorder is very important in down here.
Experimentally, we're heard to say something down there. If they lose control of that, because there's a lot of things that I don't understand, fluctuations, but they say that experimentally very difficult.
But you might, what you really want is this quantum critical case. I guess I should draw this picture. So a nice thing about quantum critical points, so here's your temperature, here's some coupling, here's the quantum critical point, is that their influence grows as you go to higher temperature. And that's because, so suppose you're at some point here, there are going to be two scales, okay? One scale is the temperature, and one scale is going to be some mass scale that you get because of a lot of the quantum critical points. Okay, now if the temperature is bigger than this scale, then you can neglect this scale and treat the theory as though you're at the quantum critical point at finite temperature. So that's some region a bit like this. So this whole region here is where the temperature is the main deformation away from criticality, not just the fact that you're not at the quantum critical point. So this whole region is the quantum critical region, if you like. And so if there is a quantum critical point down here, it could influence the physics potentially up here as well. Okay. It may be that these are not second order. That's another possibility. I'm not sure.
So you can find a temperature
or something. Physics. So obviously there's some cutoff. I mean, So is that what happened?
So what's that problem? So what's that? What sets us here?
This scale? Yeah, I think I don't know. I mean, in fact, I don't think it's okay. I mean, well, it depends what other scales are in the system, right? I mean, so if the theory was exactly, you know, like suppose you had purely phi to the fourth. So an example of this is phi to the fourth theory in three dimensions, okay? And then you have the Wilson-Fisher fixed point. So that was nature and there was nothing else. There'd only be two scales, the mass and temperature. I mean, it would go all the way up, but obviously, so it depends what other scales are knocking around. Yeah. Okay. Right, so, okay. Just because this might be useful, not because it's something I'm going to come back to, but this is why the pseudo gap is called the pseudo gap. So this is in a high TC superconductor. This is a tunneling microscopy. So you take your needle, you hold it near the sample, and you vary the voltage, and you count how many electrons jump as a function of voltage. And what that tells you is how many electrons are in the sample as a function of energy. Okay, so this is energy. This is the voltage difference to the sample. And this is essentially how many electrons jump. And then you're doing this at different temperatures. And so for this guy, TC is about this curve, something like here. And so here you're in the superconducting state, and this is the normal state. And this gap, this depletion of states below some mass scale, energy scale, is precisely the energy gap. Okay, and the pseudo gap is the fact that unlike in BCS theory, the gap doesn't close as you go into the normal state, but there's still a depletion of electrons at low energies in the normal state. Okay, so that's these curves. So that shouldn't happen in BCSD. Another anomaly of the high TC superconductors, which is going to be very related to this quantum critical point. Okay, what's the point? Okay, so look, this high TC phase diagram is not understood one possibility is that there's a quantum critical point nearby. And so now I'm going to show you one, which would be great because it would give you a handle. So the point about, OK, how do you approach a system? Either you do a weak coupling expansion or you do a strong coupling expansion. But what if you're in the middle? OK? And, right. And so a quantum critical point is one natural starting, one point of entry onto physics that's kind of just generically strongly coupled, but not so strongly coupled that you could expand in some parameter. OK. So that's why it would be nice if there was a quantum critical point in the cuprate phase diagram. And here's some evidence for one, but fairly recent. So a long time ago, it was observed that the resistivity in the cuprate, so in this strange middle phase, so if you just go up here, the resistivity goes something like this. So this is rho and temperature. It's zero, obviously, when you're in the superconducting phase. And then it jumps. Now, what normally happens for a normal Fermi liquid is that it goes quadratically in temperature. What is observed in these cuprates and also in the heavy fermions, well, okay, in the cuprates, say, is that it grows linear with temperature over many, many, a very big range of temperature. Okay. And in fact, Joe argues in his lectures that you cannot get this linear temperature resistivity by adding any relevant operator into this action. So Joe argues that this cannot be described in effective field theory, in an effective field theory of this form, which seems like a strong case for having a strong non-BCS theory. But then some people did an interesting thing. So what he so the original measurements of the resistivity were just here. Okay? Yeah.
So this argument that you just mentioned, is it relies on the fact that the operators you construct are constructed from some fundamental fields of a fixed scaling dimension? I mean,
I guess obviously the argument is not, I don't think it's a rigorous no-go theorem. It's something like you couldn't think of any. I think he assumes that there's some Lagrangian, some action of this form for fields, and that you can think of it, but you should be able to. I mean, if it's weakly coupled, if there are weakly coupled quasi particles, you should be able, by definition, be able to do this.
Sector that would describe the, you know, fight as a force appearance of interaction, but the coupling, it couples to an operator which can have, you know, some funny dimension.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's covered by Joe's argument.
Probably not. No, I don't think. Bigger. You're saying, but that is not weakly coupled. You're saying there's some
I'm saying there is, for example, the Fermi size weakly coupled. There is a bilinear coupling to an operator O, right? But that operator O does not have a dimension 2 or 3 or something like that.
No, but you see, if you can integrate out this operator, then you get an effective action. I mean, you can really forget. So the effective action is really this, right?
Well, effective action in principle, right?
So no, but you know the dimension of psi because psi is a weakly coupled guy who has a analytical kinetic term.
I see. So low energy effective action will always do that as long as psi has a fixed, it doesn't have large anomalous dimension,
right,
which is what it means. We could, okay.
But I'm not saying they're not loophole. I'm just, this linear temperature dependence is a very interesting thing and may suggest that it's strongly coupled.
Okay.
And so in fact, so the original, and this was these measures, this was known like within the year of the discovery of ITC superconductors. More recently, actually, I think it might have been done before in some different compounds. But I think this, I came across this paper, so I'm going to show you this plot. And so what they do is they want to follow the resistivity down into the superconducting region to see if there's a quantum critical point there. But they don't want the resistivity to go to zero. Okay, so what they do is apply a huge magnetic field to get rid of the superconductivity, okay, and then they follow it down and see what happens. Okay. So they do that, and it's very interesting. So these are two curves, these are experimental curves at different values of the doping. So I think one is going down sort of here, another one's going down here. And what we see is temperature and resistivity. And you see that in I think it's this line, this linear resistivity curve goes almost all the way effectively down to zero temperature. Whilst if you're a little bit away, it stops following its linear scaling if you go down here. And that is sort of strong evidence. In fact, there's a scaling law that goes all the way down to zero temperature that might suggest that there's some fundamental point. You have to apply a really huge magnetic field to do this, I think, I understand. Okay. Right, very good. So that was, I'm not really going to solve any of these problems. I just told you what these were about was motivation to, I think it would be interesting to have a model of a superconductor that doesn't depend on weakly coupled Fermi liquid theory. Okay, that's, if we can have a working model where we can calculate things in. Now, if that's not a good motivation for you, I just want to spend one page on a different motivation, which is that, you know, I've been hearing lots of talks about the string landscape over the last few years, and many of them sort of, there are methodological, so there appear to be many vacua of string theory. That seems to be a true statement. Most people believe this statement. Okay. Now, this potentially poses methodological problems for string cosmology or string particle physics, because we only have one universe, right? But there are many vacua, so how do we predict anything, et cetera? Okay. However, I'm not making a strong statement, but the idea of a landscape resonates in some way with atomic physics, which also has a landscape, okay? And so it's fun to make a graph like this one. So this is the atomic landscape, and this is the string landscape. And so we have a microscopic theory, which would be M theory, or maybe it's the standard model. Then we have the fundamental excitations, which we don't know in M theory, but in atomic landscape, they're leptons, quarks, and photons. Then you have a vacuum, right? So it's maybe it's a flux compactification of string theory, or maybe it's just an atomic lattice of the sort that all around us in the room. And then you have the low energy excitations, right, which we do know in the string theory. They're gravitons, gauge bosons, moduli, intersectons, etc. And in the atomic landscape, you have your electrons, which address bonons, spinons, triplons, what have you, bisons. And then these, obviously, you have some low energy effective theory that describes this. So there's a landscape in atomic physics. And this might suggest the logic that let's look at, so this string landscape for cosmology, people are interested in Bacillus space, but actually what you really get most naturally from string theory are ADS4 vacua, okay, ADS compactifications, which have duals. And so, you know, maybe this suggests that it might be interesting to look at some statistical properties of the string landscape from the point of view of seeing them as a landscape of quantum critical points rather than a landscape of, you know, standard models. And indeed, I'm going to show you at the end that there are many superconductors in the string landscape. You know, I don't really know where this is going, but I like the idea of trying to do something positive with the string landscape. So you have many of something. So let's see what their properties are. Let's not think of it as a problem. And you know, one day, if we can ever engineer one of these field theories in the ADS4 dual, then we could really, you know, probe this landscape experimentally. Okay, anyway, enough. So now let me tell you about holographic superconductors. So supposing that for either of those reasons I told you or for some other reason, you wanted to have a model of a strongly coupled superconductor where you could calculate things. Okay. So, you know, the way I know how to do this is to try to use ADS CFT. So I think just in case, I should maybe spend just 2 minutes reminding you how ADS CFT works. So at ADS CFT, it's a duality, so you have two theories that are meant to be the same. Schematically, you have your CFT, which you think of as living on a boundary. Then you have a bulk, which is sort of has gravity in it. And there's meant to be a one-to-one correspondence between these. So how might this work? So the way it works is that you have states in the bulk that correspond to operators in your field theory. And so the most basic one, you have gravity, okay, so you better have a metric in the bulk. And what this is dual, what the properties of the metric in the bulk tell you about are the energy momentum tensor in the field theory. Okay? Now, very good. So that's, you know, step one. Now, if we want to study superconductivity, we want to study the conductivity in particular, so there'd better be a current, some electric current in your field theory. So if you want to have an electric current in your field theory, it turns out that you need to add a Maxwell field in the bulk. Okay. And roughly the way it works is that global symmetries in the boundary become gauge symmetries in the bulk. And then finally, if we want to break the symmetry spontaneously, we're going to have at least one charged operator so that we can condense it. This is the minimal dynamics that we need to study. So if we need a charged operator, that turns out to be dual to a charge scalar field in the bulk. Okay, so if we want to study the CFT dynamics of these three operators, a minimal description we need in the bulk is in terms of these three fields. Okay, so I told you the field contents. Now we need some dynamics for them. Oh, so this is one. So I'm going to work with a 2 plus 1 CFT, and the bulk is going to be 3 plus 1 dimension. So what is this extra, just in case there's someone who doesn't know, there's one extra dimension in the bulk. What is it? So it's this radial direction. And what that tells you about is the energy scale of the field theory. So, for example, this CFT has a scale invariance in which you rescale all the coordinates and time by that amount. The ADS metric, so this is a certain space, it's Andy de Sitter space. That's the metric of Andy de Sitter space. So if you do this scaling, then, and you also scale, then to make this metric be invariant, you also have to scale the radius. Okay? Now, if the radius is scaling, okay, so if T goes like that, then energies scale like this. So let me see if I can even get this right. So at the boundary, in these coordinates, the boundary is at R equals 0. So if we're scaling inwards, that means we're scaling the energies down, okay? So this region here is low, has a low energy physics, high R physics, and this region near the boundary is the UV, the high energy physics. And so, for example, suppose we want to study the theory at finite temperature, okay? Temperature leaves the high energy physics intact, and it only changes the low energy physics, okay? So we'd expect to deform this geometry only in this region if we wanted to look at it at finite temperature. And we do this by putting in a black hole sitting in the middle of Andy de Sitter space. And indeed, that changes the geometry at low energies, but not the high energy. Anyway, ADCFT geometrizes the energy scale. That's what it does. Okay, so we have our three fields in the bulk, and we need some action to tell us what they do. Okay, so
the extra tensor indices in the bulk.
Yeah, they're gauge from away. So because there's a gauge symmetry here, so there's an AR, a TR mu,
yeah,
and a TR
right, those things.
So the best thing to do is work on the gauge where there's zero. But you can always, I mean, there is an invariant mapping gauge radius, so I actually really pull these out for these. So normally people work in the gauge with these are zero, but you could do a gauge invariant. So what I mean, the fact that there's a gauge symmetry in the bulk means that the degrees of freedom match up.
Superconductivity that you mentioned before is related to a spontaneous breaking of local symmetry. Mm-hmm. So in these models, you can study spontaneous breaking of local symmetry.
So let me say various things about this. It can be a confusing. So what Alex is correctly complaining about is I told you before that supersymmetry was a spontaneously broken local symmetry, and in these theories I'm about to tell you about, the U1 symmetry is global. Okay. So let's look at what normally happens. So let's take BCS theory. So BCS theory is a theory of phonons and electrons. There are no photons. Okay. And that's because the Coulomb interaction is screened. And similarly, what I'm going to tell you here is a theory of the metal, but the assumption is going to be that there are no photon loops. Okay, so we can always add in, we can always gauge the symmetry by adding a U1 background, right? I mean, you can add a background gauge field, and so the approximation we're working in is that that's sufficient, that you don't have to include virtual photons. But that's the same approximation that every other theory of superconductivity also makes. Okay, so. So I'm not doing anything that's any different from any textbook. Okay. But it's important to be aware that there's. So the only thing that you might not be able to. Well, I'll talk a bit about the Meissner effect.
Yeah. Okay. So, right. So you will talk exactly what the difference is that you will not be able to see.
Yeah. I'll hope. I will.
In particular, does that mean that strong interacting physics, wherever you stick with your CFT, is due to strong interactions? Due to Coulomb interactions, so strong electromagnetic interactions, does that mean that they can't be captured in this?
No, well, okay, so very good. Okay, is this a confusing point? Because I tell you that the Coulomb interaction is screened, but ultimately all of the identified physics is due to the Coulomb interaction and the Fermi exclusion principle. Okay, so it's not that the Coulomb interaction is not important. The claim is that you want some effective field theory that doesn't include photons. So for example, I mean, if you've got some magnetic force like this S dot S prime interaction, some exchange interaction, so for sure the Coulomb interaction is important. But once I've got this description, I don't need the photons anymore. So what you really need is an effective field theory description that doesn't have photons in it. And that could be strong interaction, and ultimately those interactions are electromagnetic, but you don't describe them in terms of weakly coupled photons. Is that, so the CFT is the effective field theory, and it's strongly coupled in this case, but you just don't want there to be any photon loops. So all the effects of electromagnetism you want are already captured in the effective field theory. That's what I mean. Just exactly like this. So really, the exchange interaction is the... It's also due to the Coulomb interaction, but you don't include it. You don't include it in this model.
So I guess you're saying you have some strongly coupled system. You rewrote them in terms of some different degrees of freedom, but the coupling to electromagnetism is weak. So you can...
That's right. It's weak.
Turn off the coupling to the external photon. That's what you're doing.
Yes, I mean, I want to put in an external photon is okay. I mean, you just put in a background field. But what you really turn off are photon loops. Yes?
So the reason that the photon is easy. So, why just turn out the photon completely? So it would sense that the photon is important in conventional experience.
It's just not important. So the whole dynamics of the superconducting phase transition, this whole pairing, nothing to do with photons. I mean,
right. So
I mean, ultimately it does. Look, this is the thing. At some level, the only reason that the electrons see the lattice is because of photons, right? But the effective field theory doesn't have that information in it.
Right.
Okay. That's sort of the distinction. So what I'm presenting you is like BCS theory. Sorry?
So we can only care about.
Right, you know, yeah. Right. But you want to be able to gauge it, because you want to calculate the conductivity, as we go on in a second. I definitely want to put it in an external electric field, okay, to see what happens.
So it's not so much you're integrating, there's no photon loops, you're saying you're integrating out the electromagnetic interactions, and that's in your CFT, and you're only going to probe the conductivity measurements. It's only you're only probing things with very weak.
Everything's going to be linear, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And also, you do have interventional CDCS in the vault, right?
No, well, the bulk is more like a Higgs mechanism. So in the bulk, there's really a fundamental scalar, and that's what's condensing. That scalar is going to be some composite operator. Let's just make you think right now that probably you could set up a weakly coupled BCS thing in the bulk, and that might be dual to something interesting, actually. And what about that? You could imagine having some fermions that pair in the bulk. And then So you've got these fields, and we need an action. We need to describe the dynamics. So let's write down the simplest Lagrangian that we can. So at this point, it's phenomenological, and so you write down, you've got a metric. So you write down an Einstein term. You have a conformational constant. So by the way, the ADS, the conformational constant, is important because you want to get ADS, which gets you this R squared, which allows this thing to be invariant under this scaling. Okay. You have, this is your Maxwell term, and then let's just write down the simplest thing we can for charge scalar fields. This CFT is indeed Lorentz. Was that a question about the CFT being Lorentz invariant?
Well, I'm just looking at Lorentz, but maybe it means the CFT.
Yeah, this is Lorentz. Well, the bulk, it had better be Lorentz. 3 plus 1 Lorentz invariant. The CFT is, in this case, going to be 2 plus 1 Lorentz invariant. So CFT is coupled with a number called the dynamical critical exponent. And what that tells you is how time and space are in the wrong place for the deck. So there's a scaling of time and space, right? And so if this, the relativistic case is when Z is 1. Okay. In principle, it doesn't have to be 1. In fact, for the heavy fermion compounds, it's 2 or 3, depending whether it's ferromagnetic or anti-ferromagnetic, or vice versa. for the cuprates, there's a reasonable chance that it's one, because it turns out, well, okay, if we start with this mod insulator, so, okay, let me just, quantum critical points that arise in insulating magnets or insulating valves and relativistic. Okay, I can tell you about that later. But indeed, for simplicity, I'm going to take the simplest case of ADS-T, which is Lorentz invariant case. But there are Lorentz invariant points in relativistic matter physics, and there may even be one near the cuprates. Okay, so there are four dimensionless parameters in this effective Lagrangian. One of them is the central charge of the dual CFT, which is basically the ADS radius in Planck units. Then there's going to be the DC conductivity. So this is the coefficient of the Maxwell term. It's going to turn out to be the DC conductivity in a normal state, without superconductor. The mass of the field in the bulk determines the conformal dimension of the field theory in the bound of this operator O. So operator O has a conformal dimension delta. And then there's a charge Q, which is the charge of the operator that's going to condense. The Q is integer, yeah.
Now, you've now respected the coefficients of the Maxwell term to be the permittivity rather than conductivity.
Okay, so, yeah. So this is the, okay. Okay, ADS-CFT works something like this. So I told you there was this correspondence between operators. Okay, so suppose the conductivity is a two-point function of the currents. Okay, that's the conductivity. And the way you get that is by differentiating the action twice with respect to A. The field theory A. So, I mean, this is going to be a bit schematic, but I mean, one way you can calculate this two-point function is by, sorry, I guess I wanted a Z here.
I thought there were powers of omega in the frequency.
Yeah, there are powers of omega, yes.
And I thought in the conductor, it's like the permittivity is a function of omega. I'm just going to pull it
okay,
omega.
So a nice thing about 2 plus 1 dimensions is that the conductivity is dimensionless. Okay, so the DC conductivity is just a number. Okay, and what I was getting in that, so there are factors of omega, but when you take the omega as a zero limit, they all drop out. Okay, this is why I wasn't writing them. But I'll be more careful in a second. But this, all I want to say is we differentiate the action twice with respect to A, and essentially that picks up this 1 over g squared here. So we're in 2 plus 1 dimensions. Okay, in general, there are factors of omega. Okay, so now, but what I've told you so far is not going to be enough to get. So we put in all the minimal ingredients, okay, these three fields. But that's not going to be enough to get a superconducting phase transition because we're in a scale invariant theory. Okay, so if we want to have some critical TC below which there's superconductivity, we need to introduce a scale. So in a CFT, there are only two temperatures, zero and finite, okay, because all the finite temperatures are equivalent by scale invariant. So if you want a critical temperature, you need another scale. And so the simplest way to do that with the ingredients that we have is to work with the finite chemical potential mu. And then if there is a TC, by dimensional analysis, it's going to be proportional to mu. So okay, it turns out that the dual geometry to having the theory at a finite temperature and the chemical potential is the Reisen-Nordström black hole. That means that basically this black hole is electrically charged. And the electric charge of the black hole gives you the chemical potential. And then it turns out, okay, so there you go. And that's your normal state. So the state of this theory at a finite chemical potential is given by the Reisen-Nordström by this theory in the bulk with a charged black hole background. Now, that's the normal state. Now, it turns out that this can be unstable, not for one, but for two reasons. Okay, so the first reason was pointed out by Gubser, although I guess the physics behind it is implicitly known for a long time. It's very closely connected to something called superradiance in black holes. And so what happens is that when you include, so this charged scalar field has sort of an extra mass term coming from this guy squared. Okay, there's an a squared phi squared mass term. And in a background electric field, that gives you a negative mass. Okay, so a charge scalar field in an electric field background has an extra negative mass, which is something like this. It's exactly this. Yes. That's right. It's important that you're in ADS, because otherwise you need sort of a stimulated instability. It's not a real instability. But in ADS, you have the waves, they sort of bounce back from the boundary. It's like in the box. And so you get a sort of genuine instability in that. So it's like the black hole bomb, I guess. Okay. But Gubbs realizes connection to superconductivity in this case. So basically your effective mass, even if this mass is stable, the fact that it's in a charged background, this is a schematic, and this has some R dependence, okay? It's not a constant mass. That makes it more negative, and eventually it can become unstable, and this scalar field will turn on, which is the dual to the condensation. Another nice mechanism that can happen, actually even for a neutral scalar field, is the following. So this is your ADS. Let's go all the way to zero temperature. So at zero temperature, this Weissner-Nordstrom black hole has an ADS2 region here. We have ADS4, ADS2. So the criterion for stability in ADS is something called the Brighton-Ohner-Friedman bound. Okay, and what it says for ADS4 is that the mass has to be bigger than -9/4. So the mass can be a little bit the mass squared can be a bit negative because you're in a box. Basically, ADS is like a box. But ADS2 also has a Brighton-Ohner-Friedman bound. Okay, and the Brighton-Ohner-Friedman bound in ADS2 is actually stronger than the Brighton-Ohner-Friedman bound in ADS4, and also you have to rescale. The radius of the ADS2 is not the same as the ADS4 radius. So it turns out that you can have a scalar field that's above the Brighton-Ohner-Friedman bound in ADS4, but below the Brighton-Ohner-Friedman bound in ADS2. And those scalar fields are going to be unstable as you go to zero temperature for this sort of geometric reason. You have some scalar field with some mass squared, and it's perfectly happy here, but if it goes into this region, it's going to condense and become classically unstable.
A few more words about what it's going to do when it condenses. I mean,
it wants to deform
the geometry, I guess.
I'm getting there.
Yeah. Okay.
So this is just the instability. Right. So that's right. So what I'm telling you so far is we've got some temperature, and we're lowering it at a finite mu, and there's some TC, and I'm telling you that something happens if you pull it down below this TC.
I didn't
catch
for
these two camp. Okay, very good. So in ADS, you can have a negative mass squared as long as it's not too negative.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm saying that in ADS2, you can also have a negative mass squared, but it cannot be.
I got that. I should understand why we're talking about ADS2. Where is that?
Oh, because let's just go all the way to zero temperature.
Yeah. This is the near throw geometry.
That's right. And there's an extreme old black hole. Okay. And so if you heat it up, there's some critical temperature where it becomes stable again. And in fact, you can combine these arguments and you get an exact criteria for when it's unstable. So this gamma is basically a ratio of the electric and gravitational force strength. So it's unstable if the off this gamma is just setting the units of charge. So just set it to one mentally, if you like. And so this tells you if the charge of the field is sufficiently bigger than its conformal than its scaling dimension, then you're going to get an instability at some temperature. So this follows from combining these arguments, and then these arguments are not rigorous, but we also got in numerically the same curve. So this curve seems to be right. But wait, one second. I completely agree. The fact that it's happening basically entirely in this ADS2 region does suggest that there should be some nice field theory understanding, and I don't have that at this point.
Maybe it
certainly seems pretty universal. So maybe there's I don't know. It's a good question.
Right, the final state is always thermodynamically favorable
too. Okay.
Since you've been stopped anyway, the pictures you're drawing.
I don't have lunch.
I don't actually have any appointments this afternoon. But the pictures you've been drawing are sort of implicitly or suggest global coordinates. So does it matter?
No. Okay, I'm really inconformate on this. Okay. It's just I find it conceptually.
Would it matter?
No, I think the same thing does too. In fact, there's a paper on adding rotation to this story, and then working global coordinates. So this is a plot of the scaling dimension of the operator, the charge of the operator. If you're in the colored region, you're unstable, and the more red the color is, the higher the higher TC. So this is a sort of contour plot of TC. So this this line is the BPS line. So in a supersymmetric theory, if you have any one thing stability, you have to have a mode in this small region.
Are you going to comment, what does instability mean when I just a technical guy and sit and do the computation? What I will see? So you showed there is a criteria, so the BF bound, one way of thinking is that BF bound is violated, right?
Well, there's like a modified BF bound for charge scalars. Yeah, like this is the Brydenoff-Levin bound for charge scalars, if you like. I mean, the way you do this computation, where you perturb the background,
right? Different. So that's at a linearized level.
Yeah, at the moment everything's linearized, right? So, but no longer. So, right. So obviously, what you want to know is what the endpoint of this instability is. So that's going to describe this phase, okay? The superconducting, the putative superconducting phase. And so you look for a solution, and so the ansatz is you're looking for a hairy black hole, okay? So you're going to have this scale. This charge scale is going to be non-zero. There's going to be an electric field, and you're going to have two metric functions now. So GTT is not the same as GRR. So we just picked some mass. This is a nice mass. It's the conformal mass in ADS4. And so you just solve it numerically. So you can solve Einstein's equations. And from the solution, so the scalar field at large radius is going to behave something like A over R plus B over R squared. As R goes to infinity. So you find the solution numerically, then you extract the large radius behavior. And then this you want to be zero for normalizability. And then this guy gives you the VEV. From that guy, you calculate the VEV of the dual operator. OK, that's the way A6T works. So once we've solved these equations numerically, I'm going to explain the details, you can read off the VEV of the scalar field. Okay. So these are plots of the VEV in two different cases. So it turns out that for this mass, you can choose two values of delta. You can either have delta equals 1 or delta equals 2. And basically, that corresponds to which one of these plots, both of these are normalizable, so you can choose. It doesn't matter. It's a small technical point. So anyway, you get two theories for the price of one with delta equals 1 and delta equals 2. And then you can plot the condensate as a function of temperature in these theories. A nice number to calculate is the ratio. Okay, this is going to be the gap in a second. I haven't showed you this, the gap. So okay, this is a classic second order transition type picture. Okay, so the condensate turns on. There's a square root behavior here. This doesn't look like a square root, but that's just because I've taken the square root of this guy. So, and it does this, and then it goes to some finite number at zero temperature. These plots, the different plots, are for different values of the charge Q. Okay, different values of the operator. Right, and so this, I'm going to show you that this is actually the mass gap in a second. So this ratio is actually the same ratio that I told you before was predicted to be 3.5 for ECS theory. Okay, so you can take a range of values, but another untypical value is 8, around something like 8. And the value measured in the high TC is between 5 and 8. I think this is just amusing. You know, it means anything, but what I'm emphasizing is that there's a number that you can calculate, which is the ratio of what's going to be the mass gap from TC. Okay? And the nice thing is it's a dimensionless number. It's all the 1, the factors of n cancel out. And so it's the kind of number that makes sense to calculate and compare with the experimental systems.
The black hole is hairy in what sense?
Just that it has a non-zero scalar field. It's not a deep sense of hair.
But it's going to have a scalar charge too, right? It's going to have a scalar charge too, right?
What do you mean by scalar charge?
Let's see if it's large.
I mean, it's purely normalizable. So there are two solutions for the same full of the guy without a scalar field and the guy with a scalar field. They have the same charges.
Those numbers are universal.
No, I don't think so. So originally if you're in the probe limit, which is the limit where the Q becomes large, as you know, yeah, then you seem to get 8 somewhat independently of the mass of the scalar fields. Okay.
When you say these things are the endpoints of the instability, I mean, what it sounds like what you're doing is you're looking directly for static solutions, do you know for sure that these static solutions are themselves stable? And have you done any evolution simulations that settle down to these things?
No, it'd be great if anyone wants to do something. So the extent of the evidence is the following. So the temperature at which these solutions start existing is the same with which the linearized instability turns on. And so this is definitely the exponentiation of the zero mode, right, when it becomes unstable. That's true. We compare the free energy, and indeed these have a, someone asked that question. So indeed, these guys have a free energy that's lower than the, and it goes, and there's a it's a second order transition. Okay, it goes like T minus TC squared, at least in these models. That may not be a universal fact, but in these models, it goes like the difference in free energy, or something like that. And no one's looked at the stability of these Hairy black holes directly. Right? There are no other. Okay. I appreciate there might be homogeneous phases or something, but there's no. Yeah. Within a minimalist AMDAS, these are the natural endpoints.
Yeah, okay.
Can you comment on the geometry? It's the same question I
asked. Oh, okay. Sorry.
Got this extra chi.
So. Yeah, so, you know, I have to say, it's okay. So as you see, these lines end before we get to zero temperature.
Yeah.
And that's because the numerics gets worse, at least the way we're doing it. Maybe there's a better way. I mean, basically, yeah, right, it turns on. So, right, so some of the charge is carried outside the black hole. So it's like there's a pair creation of negative and positive guys. So let's suppose the black hole is positively charged. Then what the instability does is send some negative charge into the black hole. So there's some charge in the condensate. And I think I think the condensate probably does look something like this, at least at not too low temperatures. And then so some of the charge is going to be carried. The scalar field has a finite value on the horizon. Now, the interesting question is what happens as you go all the way to zero temperature. And for example, in my art, does all the charge get expelled from the black hole? Okay, that's it. We don't know the answers to those questions. So the zero temperature, yeah, the zero temperature solutions are confusing and not characterized. But otherwise, it's really, there's nothing that funny. I mean, what kind of things are you concerned?
No, it's just you had ADS2, which has this instability, and so you're.
Right, it gets deformed.
You're going away from that. I was wondering.
Oh, yeah, no, strictly at zero temperature, I don't know what's going on.
Does A of key
diverge?
What's
that?
Does A of key?
No, goes to zero. A of C has to go to zero. Yeah, they're regular. I mean, they're really fine solutions. I'm not sure about the zero temperature limit, but sure. Many quantities seem to behave well to go to zero temperature.
I think Gary was telling me that you're not.
Yeah, so if
the horizon area has to shrink to zero.
I've heard that Gary's doing something. I haven't talked to him in a couple of weeks, I guess. But I think that would be the case in which all the charge gets expelled from the black hole, and I guess the horizon goes to zero, and then it may be that you have to allow some of the scalar to diverge or something. I'm not sure.
Am I going to show late as a free energy?
I'm not, because I don't have any time. But
I have a very quick question. So in this space, with the condensate, what's the free energy? Is it positive or negative?
It's lower than the resonational black hole. I mean, it obviously, right. I mean, sorry.
Okay.
I mean, there's
okay.
There's a minus.
I was curious whether there is a first order phase transition.
It seems that there's some plots in the long.
As long as if it's negative or lower than the rational
mode. So, as I say, I think the order of the transition may depend on things like the potential you put in for the scalar field. Okay, I'm not sure how robust it is, but in this model, it seems to be second order.
When there is additional phase, right, which is just periodically identified. So, I mean, like is this the normal first order phase transition, right? So, that's not captured here. So you
want the mic, you're talking about magnetic fields?
No, I'm saying that this the difference of the free energies is free energies in a black hole phase, right, where you have a horizon, so kind of deconfined phase with a condensate and without the condensate. And I'm saying how big is this free energy compared to a confined phase?
No, but we're in Poincaré coordinates.
Well, you can have, right, so you periodically identify time direction, right? So that phase would have a zero free energy.
No, but that's not favored.
Okay,
yeah,
Sean, so the mass of the scalar field, so the
it's not true. Yeah, very good. I take your point. So yes, a sub t does go to zero, but the effective mass term doesn't in the reaction. Yeah, that's a good point. Oh boy. Okay. So I'm going to run just 10 minutes, but not more. And so you can calculate the conductivity. This is, if you look at it, okay, I'm going to go a bit quickly now. I'm sorry. So this is the conductivity in a textbook for a superconductor. Okay, as a function of frequency, as you see, it's zero, and then it turns on. Okay, this corresponds to where you start pair producing electrons in the vacuum. So this is the dissipative part of the conductivity. And so if you have some sufficiently high frequency, you can start producing electrons in the vacuum, and you get a dissipative conductivity. But because there's a mass gap at frequencies below this critical frequency, conduction is dissipationless. Okay, that's what a mass gap does for you. So we calculated the conductivity for these in the superconducting. Well, very good. So I've shown you that there's a hairy state, right? We'd like to see if it's superconducting. So we calculate the critical temperature. We calculate the frequency-dependent conductivity, and it looks like this. Okay, so it's gapped. But I'm going to jump this. Then, because there are some questions about magnetic fields, so indeed, obviously, very good. The fact that there's too fast. Okay, so there's a delta function here. So you see this gap, and the conductivity turns on, and it tends towards its value in the normal state. But there's actually a delta function at zero frequency. And that corresponds to the fact that I showed you that the conductivity was like I over omega. Okay, that was just a general argument. And so if the imaginary part has a pole, causality implies that the real part has to have a delta function. So really, the conductivity looks like that. It's a general property of causality. Okay, there's a relation between the real and the imaginary parts of retarded Green's functions. And that tells you that when there's a pole in the imaginary part, the real part has a delta function. The real part is the dissipative. So it's not that the conductivity vanishes here, okay? It's just that the real part of it vanishes. So there's no dissipation. Right? Okay, but there's the delta function, and which is the coefficient of the pole. So J is sigma E, and so that's sort of I over omega E. So then what I was telling you is that let me now rewrite this as in terms of the potential. So you get this equation back again. All right, and this is called the London equation. If you take the curl of this equation and use Maxwell's equations, you're going to get that the photon becomes massive. Okay, you're going to get something like this. So there are two steps, right? So, and this would be the Meissner effect. This would tell you the magnetic fields can't penetrate. But here, I've used Maxwell's equations, okay, which is not something that I have in the CFT. So the extent to which the CFT can see the Meissner effect is that what you know is that if you put it in the background electric field, you generate currents, okay, and they're diamagnetic currents. So what that means is that if you then coupled it to a dynamical photon, the currents in the system are such that they want to expel the photon. So the physics of the Meissner effect is the generation of these diamagnetic currents. Okay, the fact that you then couple it to a photon is like a secondary thing. So these superconductors generate diamagnetic currents. Okay, you can't actually see the expulsion of the magnetic field, but they generate the currents. If you turn on a magnetic field, it kills superconductivity, and so you can calculate. So this plot shows you, for example, that if you have some, this is TC, so the magnetic field zero, that's the critical temperature. As you turn on a magnetic field, the critical temperature goes down, and if the magnetic, these plots are for different values of the charge, and if the magnetic field is sufficiently big, it's never superconducting.
Be positive?
Actually, yes, because it follows from some property of the Green's function, say, I think. Positivity of dissipation of energy. I mean, it definitely is positive in the examples we calculated. I think it has to. Okay, so I just want to very quickly come back to this landscape just for 2 minutes. So it's nice to embed superconductors into string theory, the story I told you. So this action I was using in the bulk, I more or less just made it up. But it'd be nice to actually have a string theory completion, then you actually know what the field theory is that you're talking about, and you know what the operators that condense are. So I'm going to look at some a sort of simple landscape, which is ADS4 across X7, where X7 is Sasaki-Einstein. And this is what you get if you trace them two lane for the tip of the clavial, and the action is being conjectured to look something like this. So it's a bunch of Chern-Simons theories with different levels, and then there's some bifundamental matter. I don't know exactly what the state is, so whatever. Okay, this is the n equals 2 case. So what we did is we looked at the stability of these ADS4 plus X7 vacua, well, not ADS4, where ADS4 means vice and Nordstrom ADS4. And it turns, so the stability, these are called Freud-Rebane compactifications, but we're putting them at a finite charge density. It's actually very complicated to study it with a finite charge density because, okay, in the absence, in the pure ADS case, you have scalar modes, vector modes, tensor modes, they all decouple, and you can study them all separately. When you have a charge density, because there's an A mu lying around, it can couple your vectors and tensors and scalars. And so it's really a mess. So Frederick and I found at least one mode that decouples at a linearized level from everything else. So we're going to look at the stability with respect to this mode. Okay. So it turns out that if your Sasaki-Einstein has moduli, which many of them do, you can build a three-form mode that linearly decouples from everything else. I'm sorry, this is very quick. But this is the way you build this three-form is you start with your clavial cone of the Sasaki-Einstein space, and you can build a closed self-dual, anti-self-dual 3-1 form. This is the canonical four-form on the clavial. This is your metric modulus. Okay, this gives you a 1-3 form on the cone. You project that with DDR. You basically project that onto the Sasaki-Einstein space, and you get a three-form on the Sasaki-Einstein space. Okay, it turns out to be charged. Basically, what this is in the bulk, this is the super partner of the modulus mode. So there's a scalar in the bulk, okay, which is the modulus of this Sasaki-Einstein space. That's neutral, because the modulus has to preserve the U1 symmetry of the Sasaki-Einstein. But its super partner, this three-form mode, is charged. And it turns out this mode is always unstable. It has delta equals 2 and charge 2. It's a BPS mode. And then, so what you then do is we know the charge, so we go back to our plot, and we say we have charge 2, 2, and then we read off the critical temperature by comparing with this plot. And so it turns out that any Sasaki-Einstein space that has a modulus becomes superconducting at temperatures below this temperature. So in some temperature units of the chemical potential, and this is setting the charge. And so there are lots of Sasaki-Einstein spaces. So we did a scan over some Sasaki-Einstein. So this is sort of, if you like, a slight parody of scans of the cosmological constant in the string landscape. And so we have a plot. We found 10,000 Sasaki-Einsteins, okay, with moduli. I didn't tell you how, but you find them. And then you calculate TC for each one. And then this is the number of solutions, log number of solutions, and this is TC over mu in Kelvin millivolts. And so anyway, there's some distribution in the space of theories of the critical temperature. And so, you know, you might like to ask questions like, is there a maximal critical temperature you can get in string theory, for example? You also have a S7, which doesn't have any moduli, but it does have another mode, a nice mode. And this theory is dual to something called ABGM theory. And so this shows that ABGM theory has a superconducting phase at finite chemical potential. It's actually more. It's actually okay. So we did there's some algebraic equation that defines the clavial, and then you take the cone over this. So we just scanned over these things up to some number 100. Okay. But actually, there are infinite families. There are 21 or something infinite families down here. They all have a small. So basically, you can show that within this set of examples, TC is bounded above. We don't know what the limit bound is, but you can show it's bounded, and that there are infinitely many of them, but they only take about 20 different values for conductivity. And so, like this thing, this bin is really infinite, but all the rest, everything else is finite.
But there's an in,
infinite number that sit at some finite number that is not zero.
That's not zero. That's right. In fact, there's a lower bound also.
Kind of make the same logical observation. You mean whichever happens before.
That's right. So there's another instability of this theory of finite number potential. It's kind of interesting. So you know you have this mode, it has mass spin minus two, so there are two full offs. So if I converted the units correctly between two papers, which, okay, there's a finite chance I didn't, I think that with one of them, the Gaussian major one happens first, and the other one, this one happens first. But actually, with the more natural one, which is the one of the R squared full off, then the Gaussian major one happens first.
The reason why there's a dissect is very.
There are not very many points out here. It's been a while playing around with the bar charts to make it look nice, but I mean, at some point, they're not many. Okay, so sorry to everyone. So I told you that superconductivity was due to spontaneous symmetry breaking, and that established theories of superconductivity depended on having a weakly coupled picture of superconductivity has some electrons, and then it has some glue, and everything's described by quasi-particles. And it would be nice to have a theory of superconductivity that didn't have any quasi-particles. So having emphasized that these things I've shown you don't have any quasi-particles. There's spontaneous symmetry breaking occurs naturally in ABCFT. I didn't put in, you know, some people model, standard model in QCD, in ABCFT, and they really put in the Higgs, some Higgs potential in the bulk. Okay, I didn't do that. I just put in the minimal ingredients I needed, and the spontaneous symmetry breaking happened dynamically by itself. And I know that there's a certain conceptual resonance between the string theory and the condensed matter landscapes. And then finally, I showed you that many n equals 2 theories of stacking Einstein duals have superconducting phases. Thanks. Yeah, that's good. Good. That's right. So, so you have to ask the question: Is it a well-defined quantity?
I have to define the
order. Right. Exactly. So, but actually, interestingly, I found out recently that high TC may be one place where TC of a V does make sense. So mu is going to basically be related to the Fermi energy. So it's the size of the Fermi surface effectively. And an interesting thing. An interesting thing about high TC is that it seems that in this underdocked region here, okay, the interesting region, it seems that the Fermi surface is much smaller than it might naively be, and that there are these Fermi pockets or Fermi arcs. So if this is in momentum space, they're like these little bumps where the electrons are localized. Okay, I can tell you more about this. It's related to the fact that it's a D-wave superconductor. Okay, so you have these, and these, the size of these little bumps can set a kind of mu, can be used to define a mu, if you like, which is not the natural mu. So the mu in the normal state, in the normal Fermi liquid, is much, much bigger. So you can take TC over this mu, and that's a reasonable quantity. And there's some problem with units, but I think it lands up pretty small. In fact, these are really big. Look, so this cells, the systems of 1 millivolts. You can do it, and you end up down here.
So why am I cannot try to define mu with I, so the density of the charge is a carrier, so like.
That's what this Fermi energy is. But the thing is that there may be other scales that are more important than mu, like. What is the NBCS theory? The condensate NBCS theory is not tied to a chemical protector. It may not be a well defined quantity, but also different methods.
Right, sure. Since you brought up the other scales, since by doing your calculation, TC is over real, is a constant for, I think, the Sasaki.
Yes.
But for a real material, so you have to hold dull for a given material. So that's.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's right. So this would absolutely. That's a good
idea. Okay, so So, I mean, that by itself seems to be saying that really the quantum critical points say cannot be very,
expensive. Yeah, okay. Can I rephrase? So, I think what they're saying is that this plot would be something linear, right? I mean, it seems to be proportional to me.
Right.
Look, I'm making absolutely no strong claims about how closely connected any of this is to the ITC returns. I see it as a. The thing is, what I think what would make me happy, only to try to emphasize to maybe the kinetic community that. You know, this is a toy model that is not weakly coupled where you can calculate stuff, and then maybe we can. You need to think of different concepts, right? So you don't have photons and electrons and stuff. You just have operators, right? You have your charge, the current, the energy, the tensor, the condensate, and hopefully it's a useful model. That's all. So it goes.
Yeah. If really you're simply not going to a perpendicular magnetic field,
yes.
You know, the field of penetrates and your vortices.
Yes.
Do you know what would the box theory corresponding to give you the dynamics of the vortices?
Which of the vortices?
Would it be a box theory to give you the dynamics of the
That's actually very that's all what to do some numerics. This might be an interesting so exactly. So if you put it in the magnetic field, it does penetrate. But it's not easy to solve. Very good. So right, so I showed this. If you make a phase diagram where this is temperature and magnetic field, perpendicular magnetic field has been 2+1 orthogonal. So at zero magnetic field, there was a TC, and below here there was a superconducting phase. Okay. Then what you can study, we studied directly, if you can look at this curve, which this tells you how TC changes as a function of magnetic field. There's some critical magnetic field above which there's no superconductivity. Now, what you're asking in this region here, which is if you really go into the superconducting phase with a magnetic field, there should be some vortex lattice. It's very hard to describe because in the bulk, it's going to be dependent. It's going to, okay. So everything we're doing is just ODEs. So all the functions just only depend on the radial direction in the bulk. And so if you have a lattice, this is going to have to depend on the radial direction, but also the spatial dimensions. And then you've got PDEs, and then you need someone who can do better numerics than me too. But in principle, I think there is a vortex lattice. And actually, there will be a vortex lattice. And I think it's actually quite interesting for black holes. So these will be black holes with sort of very highly non-unique, because there'll be lots of vortices you can move around in them. I think it could be done, but it's technically difficult.
So, you have reasonably detect two superconducting.
So, in fact, so within this model, it's always going to be type two, because the photons are not dynamical, so it just never gets expelled. But actually, by construction, it's going to be type two. But so that's why it's BC2 and not BC. But there is another reason, which is that for sheets, you have a 2+1 system in a 3+1, coupled to 3+1 dimensional electromagnetism. I think these are almost always type two. And the reason is that if you want to expel a photon, so I hope this argument is right, but I think it is. So if you want to build the magnetic flux lines, you end up having to expel them from a volume. And the free energy gain from superconducting goes like the area, so you can never expel the magnetic field. So it's reasonable in these models. So this would be called the extreme type 2 limit or something.
It's very interesting for me because new picture is I am from a more type point of view of perhaps can be useful. In the sense that we were able, for example, in the last year to argue that when you take, for example, the simple Hartree Fock approach for electrons.
So, which approach?
Hartree Fock approach.
Okay, sure.
Or when you use the original Dirac approach, which you do not restrict the spin orientation, the wheel of one half and one half open, and is it breaking this symmetry? Is it not breaking this symmetry, rotational symmetry, by selecting a definite orientation for the spin? And you also liberate the block symmetry for searching a happy pop solution. And when you do this in a simple model for the type linear in the plane, then you are able to get the isolator, nitrogen, for example, for lanthanum, copper, or 6.C. And also, the what you find for the orbital are not simple orbital, but orbital we have incorporated the antiferromagnetic matrix in each of them. And then you got this one-pound picture, you know, with a gap for the lanthanum copper. And also, when you don't liberate the symmetry for the lattice, for example, and liberate the symmetry for Castilla for the spin, then you get a zero gap, a structure. Mm-hmm. For you have zero gaps in the corners. And in this sense, no, it seems that perhaps how could we use it to consider this problem?
Obviously there's a huge amount of work by real there's a lot of people on this phase diagram, and it'd be great to incorporate some of it. I think what if IDCD is going to be useful for the copper oxide, there should be some kind of hybridization between the real approach and maybe just ADCT is used for some sort of fine tune certain aspects. Yeah, I think that is right.
Is there some symmetry argument that guarantees that the charged mode decoupled? So you found in the string realizations that decoupled mode. Usually, you know, in the examples that I'm familiar with, there is a.
Yeah, maybe I was going quickly. So it's only decoupled at the linearized level. Okay. So already, for these cases.
But that's enough for you.
Well, it's enough to see the instability, it's not enough to find the hairy black hole.
But is there a symmetry argument given at the linearized level that could be? Same with examples I know that there is a symmetry argument that's only in the linear
level. I'd say the way we found it was just by looking at all the modes and actually noticing that this one decoupled. I mean, a posteriori, you can see, I mean, you really need all the properties, so it needs to be. This the form that it descends from on the caviar needs to be closed, antisocial, primitive. That'll do it. So there are a bunch of conditions that go in, especially like the primitivity one that are.
Okay. But I guess one of the conditions is that it is a unique mode of this type, because if there is more than unique, then there will be mixing between them. Whatever characterized is, this is what I'm alluding to. There are some features.
No, I don't think there is mixing, actually. I think they.
Well, then that's implicitly the statement that there is a unique mode like that.
No, there could be more than one modulus.
And but they don't mix?
I don't think so. Okay. No, we just show that if you have a form like this, it just decouples for everything else.
I suppose I do have just a simple linear couple with the Charles theorem here. What if I find a Henry that holds for all mass charge ratios is that time that you get done, or I only find a Henry that holds do I find a Henry black hole solution when the mass to charge ratio is marginal?
You mean just within the phenomenological model or now within? That's actually, so we looked at this one value of the mass, and there was a paper by Gary Horowitz and a student of his where they looked at some other values, but only like three other values. I would really like someone to just do a scan of all values. So, for example, something you need the Henry black hole solution for is to calculate delta of the mass spectrum of the TC.
Yeah.
And so, I would like to see a plot of that against the mass square, for example. Right? I mean, this should do something. Is it bounded above? Is it bounded below? So, you know, but this is a nice experimental quantity. Right?
I'm just confused.
So, this shouldn't be too hard to do.
Yeah, I'm just confused by that. If I make the mass super large, do you see a possibility that we don't have compensation?
No. I mean, you need to be in this. You need to be the mass. You need to be in the shaded region in this plot. But for all shaded region in this plot, there should be a very black hole. The blue and the red region.
Sir, why the mass? Okay. So that's off of that.
This is just the instability, the linearized instability. But the Harry Black hole is where this goes.
That is what I'm asking. Okay.
So that has not been found for all the values.
So there is not such instability when the map when the mask is marked.
No, of course, right. That's the white. That's the white. No.
If you wanted to try and follow the competition between superconductivity and any term mechanism, what would be the thing you turn on in the ADS-CFD?
Yeah, that's a good question. So right, it seems that if you could that's the right question. So if you wanted to mock up something a bit more like this phase diagram, it seems like you need some kind of other order parameter knocking around that would be the antiferromagnetism. That's right. So it would be nice to we only have one scale, which is mu. It might be you could imagine making the setup more complicated to adding another scale, which would be the
scalar.
So no, you could just add another scalar, for example. And then the bed of that scalar would be like the antiferromagnetic order, and then you could. I'm saying you can imagine having a T, a mu, which is what we're working in so far, and then having some other axis, which would be some coupling. And a coupling is a non normalizable mode. It's something that you turn on some other scalar field, maybe. However, it would be nice to make it look more like antiferromagnetism rather than just putting in an order parameter. For ferromagnetism, there's a nice, so you can have an SU2 field in the ball, for example, and you could think of that as spin. And in fact, people do this with modeling P waves, something like that. But you could add an SU2 gauge field and then just think of that SU2 as the spin. And then a condensate for that would be a ferromagnetic order, because it means the spin would be pointing up or something. But antiferromagnetism seems a bit. So I don't know what the nice. So I think there's a natural bulk way of thinking about ferromagnetism. I'm not sure about
how about D wave? Is there some way to
think about it? Well, it seems like you might need some kind of metric condensate in the bulk, some graviton, something to carry spin to condense. But I should say, so I a few weeks ago I thought that D waves. The most important question was how to deal with D waves, because that's what these things are. However, so it seems that there's some theories, so in particular, Sevier has a theory. I don't know what other people think about it, but he has a, and in this theory, what happens, he actually has S wave pairing, the actual underlying pair mechanism is S wave pairing between electrons in these opposite pockets. And so somehow the underlying dynamic is actually an S wave. And then when you just sort of change variables back into the, so you have some effective degrees of freedom to undergo S wave pairing. When you change variables back into the real electrons, it's D wave. So I'm now less sure whether it's the most pressing question or not to have a D wave superconductor. But I think you could do it. So you have your metric and then you add another charged free graviton, say, which I think you can do consistently if it's just free. And then that would probably condense, and that would give you a few more.
And you mentioned people putting skin on the black hole. What does that mean, people with CFT?
It's not a very, it means you'd have the CFT on the sphere, and then you just rotate the sphere.
What is that for?
So these points are various modes that you get in this Sacky-Einstein factorization. So this is the mode that was unstable. So these are the modes that you get on the sphere. On the S7, and this is some point that's not stable.
Okay, so maybe I suggest asking more questions at lunch.
Yeah.
So, let's now thank Sean again.